just in way of introduction to the theme, Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master, frequently says that there can be no lotus flower without the mud. A lotus flower cannot grow on marble. It needs the mud. Similarly, true compassion cannot arise without a deep understanding of suffering. Our guest today, Dr. Bosco, is a Rwandan doctor and social justice activist who has made his life into a lotus flower. He has spent his life experiencing and being a witness to suffering that most of us don't experience or cannot imagine, and developing deep compassion as a result. His life is a testimony of skillfully using the mud to grow the lotus flower of compassion. I met Dr. Bosco over a year ago in West Africa, in Liberia, in one of the most remote places that I've ever been. It's about 14 hours outside the capital city of Monrovia, and it takes, in the rainy season, our car gets stuck about five or six times, and it's just a marathon to get to the place that Dr. Bosco has lived and worked for a number of years with the organization Last Mile Health. And as I spent time with him, it was obvious that he's quite an extraordinary human being, and his journey has taken him from rural Rwanda to seminary school after the genocide in Rwanda, to medical school, to working closely with Partners in Health and Dr. Paul Farmer in Rwanda, and he is also a committed Gandhian. So it's an honor to have him with us today, and just wanted to welcome you, Dr. Bosco.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's an honor to join this wonderful community.
To start with our first question, just because your background, I think for most of us that haven't been in Rwanda, could you tell us a little bit about your childhood? What was it like growing up in rural Rwanda?
Yeah, thank you very much. As you said, I was born in rural Rwanda from a very Christian family that genuinely lives the Christian values of unconditional love, service and compassion, and especially toward the poorest and the most vulnerable people. That environment has incredibly nurtured my childhood and my personal growth, which contributed to my aspirations to something bigger, which I could not understand, of course, when I was a child. And it pushed me, it inspired me to go to seminary. However, when the genocide occurred in 1994, I was 20 years old, and I felt all my foundations were shaken. Genocide didn't just happen. It was a culmination of a vicious cycle of historical and sociological oppression, repression, and marginalization. But when I saw people suffering the worst horrible experience, I was suffering myself, but seeing people suffering, dying, and I was powerless to do anything, that made me suffer more. That was the hell. That was the moment where Rwandans experienced the height of cruelty and absurdity. And that plunged me into a very serious existential crisis.
So, growing up, would you talked about your family being growing up in a Christian family with unconditional love. Was the environment before the genocide, so the first, 16, 18 years of your life, you would say that there was a seed that was developed by your parents and the environment around you to look deeper into life and try to have a stronger purpose even before the genocide?
Yes, even before the genocide. But what the genocide did was to question all of that, because I could not believe that a human being was able to kill and to kill such a number of people. I could not believe such a cruelty and absurdity.
Mm-hmm. And so for those on the call that aren't that familiar with the Rwandan genocide, it occurred in 1994, and it was an estimation of around 800,000 to a million people that died in a matter of 90 days. Is that correct, Dr. Bosco?
Yeah.
And in that questioning, that kind of existential questioning that you're mentioning, was it a questioning of the society, or was there internal questions that were coming up as, did you feel that you were also capable of that level of violence within you that you were seeing all around you?
So at that time, I was questioning, I was trying to make sense of all that suffering around me and within me, trying to understand, why did genocide happen? Why, for instance, did so-called leaders incite people to kill one another? And I was suffering too, always wondering what would be my role to help my fellow citizens to move out of that hell. Like, my crisis was about what should I do? What does this mean? Is life absurd? Or it has a meaning? And what is my role to make it more meaningful to myself and to my people?
Mm. And so how did you move from that question, immediately after the genocide? Did you have a period of being stunned and paralyzed, or what was your next steps following the genocide?
So why I was asking those questions to myself and also to my elder people, I came across a book called Tous les hommes sont frères. This means all men are brothers. This was a Gandhi's book. And really, this helped me to understand that in Rwanda, we need spiritual politics to heal the country. I mean, Gandhi, since then, Gandhi became my role model. He inspired me that the best path to contribute to the healing of my society was social justice. And after my training in seminary, I didn't choose to continue the path for the priesthood, as I was advised by my spiritual advisor that priesthood would probably hinder my engagement to social justice. I then decided to do medical school in Rwanda.
Mm, so, with who exposed you to Gandhi? You just came across that book, All Men Are Brothers, or was it something that some of your friends were reading, or any people more senior?
So, as I was young and I was, following information around. And I was considering the case, the Rwandan case, as, Palestine, Israel. And I was trying to get, inspired by what was going on in other countries. I founded a movement for youth, a youth movement for peace. And we had a training in nonviolence. And while we were discussing and then I discovered Gandhi. I got that book from Arigius from Belgium.
From Belgium.
Yeah.
Wow. And in seminary school, did you find some of the answers that you were looking for?
Not really. You know, I was still struggling. So what Gandhi inspired me that I should take the path for social justice if I want to contribute to the healing of my society. But I didn't have the tools to do it. And then when I went to medical school, you know, I was advised to do medical school by my parents, my siblings, my friends, because they used to tell me, well, this is the field where you can express love and compassion. You can be like the receptacle of the blessings, the grace, the love of God. And then when I went to medicine, when I was in my fourth year, during my practicals in pediatrics, I visited the malnutrition ward, and I was shocked to see how a doctor with nurses were focusing on calculating the doses of fortified milk and antibiotics. And this was not only a shock, but it was also a challenge, because that child was readmitted, and my assumption was that the child got malnourished probably because of poverty. And I conclude that probably this was not my best path, because my assumption was, rather than dealing with the symptoms, we should be dealing with the cause, you know, addressing poverty.
So in the fourth year, you felt that this patient, they were addressing kind of the superficial causes of deep suffering, that the really root cause of poverty was not being addressed by the medical training.
Yes. And that worsened my existential crisis. But while I was almost about to quit medicine, I was fortunate to meet a mentor who helped me discover that as a doctor, there is a way you may go beyond the symptoms and focus on healing and development of the whole person. I discovered then the holistic medicine, that it's an approach that integrates the biological, the psychological, the cultural, and spiritual dimensions of human beings.
And did you find that there was support for this way of thinking in Rwandan medicine, or that other people were also hungering for kind of a deeper addressing of the root causes of suffering?
It was not pervasive. Only few people had that level of awareness. And we actually founded a group, a small group of 10 people within the university. We had a group called The Art of Living. So where we used to go deeper into the understanding of human beings and our mission on this earth. And this was another nurturing experience. And after my training in medicine, I joined then Partners in Health. And this was one of the best experiences where I could apply my, you know, like the medical, holistic medical approach, because Partners in Health, as an organization oriented to social justice by addressing or breaking the cycle of poverty disease. It helped me, it gave me that opportunity to apply my approach of holistic medicine.
You told me the story in Liberia of Paul Farmer asking, where can I find a Rwandan social justice doctor? And everybody that was around Dr. Paul Farmer saying, Dr. Bosco, you got to go talk to Dr. Bosco. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to work for Partners in Health and that story a little bit?
Yeah, sure. Actually, when I was in university, I was very involved in social movements. I was national leader of Young Christian Movement. And this is one of the social movements that was born, were born in Europe. And my position was known by all my colleagues. Most of time when I was like addressing the public, when I was sharing with friends, like the motto of whatever I would say was social justice. So when then Partners in Health was recruiting doctors, I think Paul Farmer had a problem that he could not find enough doctors who were exposed to the thinking and practice of social justice. And that's why he got one doctor and he asked him if he could find a doctor who was aware and who was like a social justice activist. That doctor happened to be my classmate. He naturally said, oh, I heard that word from one doctor called Dr. Jean Bosco. They came and visited me.
Nice.
That's how I got to know Partners in Health.
So you were in, this was in 2006?
Yes.
Okay. And then can you talk a little bit about your work in Rwanda with Partners in Health? Where were you? What kind of work were you doing? And what were some of the lessons that were born out of the work with Partners in Health?
You know, when I was working with Partners in Health, I was the head of infectious diseases clinic, and I was like the director of clinical director of the hospital. But having worked with people living with HIV gave me that opportunity to be exposed to more suffering, not from the war, but also from the health problem. Like, HIV was considered to some extent as a sentence, like a death sentence. But over time, I realized that holistic medicine is very important. Treating patients, giving them the pills, is not enough. They need food. They need shelter. But beyond that, they need to find the meaning of their life. I remember one patient saying, I like coming here when you are here because the number of my CD4 count increases just by the fact of meeting you.
But
she didn't just say that.
For those that don't know, CD4 count is a marker of where your HIV status is. It's immune cells. And, wow, that's quite profound.
And then she said that because, you know, I learned that doctors need to listen. The empathic listening is something very important. Love is very curative, and this is what patients with chronic diseases really need, in addition to pharmaceutical treatment. But I learned also that the poorer you are, the sicker you become. And of course, the sicker you are, the poorer you become. That's why addressing poverty and disease is very crucial to address human suffering. But my question, the question that was haunting me that time after realizing that poverty, inequality, and diseases are really linked, connected, my question was, how do you address poverty? What are the root causes of poverty? That's why I end up doing a master in sustainable development at SIT Graduate Institute in Vermont.
And so a master's in sustainable development in Vermont.
Yeah.
Okay.
And this really helped me to mature the understanding of my mission on this earth. I was born to help people heal and transcend, especially the most vulnerable. I was born for social justice. But I understood that I needed tools to do it, because you can't help someone heal unless you understand his problem. This, in medicine, we say you need to do diagnosis. But at the societal level, you also need to do social diagnosis in order to help in social healing process.
So the thing that you're saying that I feel is so profound is that you're saying that patients suffer and people suffer not only because they have a disease and they're poor, but they don't have purpose in their life.
Yes.
So that you see that as a physician, you don't hear many physicians or health providers say that part of my job is to help people understand the purpose of their life. But you feel that is one of your roles?
Yeah, I feel this is one of my role, and you can't do a social justice work if you don't help people to understand the purpose of their life, because once you do understand the purpose of your life, any event that makes you suffer, you are able to transcend it and keep moving towards the purpose of your life, towards the realization of the purpose of your life.
Wow. You also shared with me a story that I think would be great for the group to hear, that there was some conflict in the hospital in Rinkwavu in Rwanda that you were working at, and you applied some Gandhian principles to address the conflict. Could you tell us about that story?
Yeah, sure. You know, in Rwanda, it's not easy because of ethnic polarization, and people are victims. Most of people are victims of dehumanization, demonization, victimization. And that happened in Rwinkwavu. And what I did, I suggested some friends who were also aware of Gandhian method. I did a presentation. I gave a talk showing that this was during the morning week, and there was...
What is the morning week?
This is the week where people remember their victims.
Of the genocide.
of the genocide.
Okay.
And it's very intense, it's very charged. People have a lot of, tensions. And during that time, for me, it was a time where people needed to understand a different approach to honor our victims and to get to heal and get transformed from the ashes of the genocide and mass killings. So I suggested people to I showed that the Gandhian method of fasting helps us in purification, and this can honor our victims and help us heal and transform. I
Wow.
organized a team of 10 people. We did it for 3 days, and I said, as you do fast, do also contribute materially to alleviate the suffering of the survivors of genocide. And we did. This really had a very huge impact.
Wow, so addressing back to the root cause, fasting in a Gandhian way, and how is that how did that how is that accepted by your fellow Rwandans? Did it after the 3 day fast, how was the response?
We were like I could mobilize 10 people. We used to fast and do meditation together, and probably the rest of the staff and the communities, because it also reverberated in the communities around. Once they received that money. My purpose was not really to give money only, but was to awaken people that we cannot use the suffering to make more suffering, but we can use the suffering to help people heal and transform.
Wow.
And this created a lot of impact, because even people until now, I have been absent from Wimhavu for the last 4 years, but people still remember me and still send me messages saying, "Oh, we miss you. We want to hear." They used to call me Namaste. This was
Namaste. Well, getting to kind of the work that you're doing now, I think that you have a master's from the U.S. Rwanda's kind of going through this almost this renaissance where the development is happening so fast, and so many people are drawn to Rwanda, and your life and commitment has taken you to across the African continent to Liberia, and working in probably some of the toughest conditions that I've seen. So perhaps you can talk about that path from Rwanda to Liberia, and what drives that commitment where many of your colleagues could and do kind of try to career climb, and you've kind of done the opposite where you've found an even poorer population to commit your life to. So I find that inspiring and difficult, and kind of how you process that and where those motivations come from.
I have had a passion for social justice for a long time, but I have to acknowledge that I really did understand what it means profoundly after my master's in sustainable development. I was fortunate to have very special professors who helped me, you know, understand what it means. Otherwise, I was kind of romanticizing it. And my passion for social justice, this is what took me to Liberia. I know we are working in one of the hardest to reach area in Liberia with the last mile health. And people didn't believe that this was possible until we went there. And I would say that we are making the impossible possible. Because those people have been forgotten for a long time. And even the Liberians themselves were afraid to go to those communities who live in the jungle with no access to any health care service at all. But it's that passion for social justice that pushed me to say, well, I have to go. And it's been an opportunity for me to understand that. You know, suffering, we all have different levels of suffering. And it always makes sense for me as a social justice warrior to help people understand or make meaning, make sense of their suffering, and have a path to get out of that suffering. Yeah.
Wow. And the work you're doing now and your future dreams, can you talk about, I think, the kind of work that you shared with me that you want to set up in Rwanda? It'd be great to hear a little bit more about that.
Yeah, my dream as a physician, horrified by the violence and suffering unleashed by, you know, during the genocide and its aftermath, and as a Rwandan, eager to support the tremendous efforts that my country has made in terms of reconstruction, I have decided to establish a healing and transformation center to support a path for sustainable peace and development, which would attempt to empower people and conduct policy research to identify best practices in social healing and social justice. I'm saying this because in Rwanda, we have a lot of challenges. We have been focusing on reconstruction, but there is a lot of challenges in terms of distribution of income and wealth. There is a clear, growing inequality between haves and have-nots. People are still living, they still have this kind of deep-seated animosity, hostile interactions, fear, even if we paradoxically live together as neighbors. And this kind of demonization, dehumanization, victimization, in addition to blind obedience to the authority, which is always like worsened and worsened by political repression, all of that need to be addressed. We need to break the cycle and address structural violence. So my dream is to invest in the healing center, focusing on individual and community healing, but also on policies that may fuel violence in the future. And this will not end in Rwanda. I have to work, as you know, to extend my work to the African Great Works.
Well, when I think for many of us, the idea of structural violence is familiar, but could you kind of give and also social justice, could you describe a little bit more what you mean about structural violence and even social justice, what that means to you?
So structural violence, this is, we live in a world that many people think it's peaceful, but peace is deeper than what many people think it is. If peace is beyond, physical security, and violence, direct violence, is understood, war or, any kind of form of direct violence. But there is another violence which is unseen by many people, and this is found on injustices. You have unjust, structures, unjust distribution of wealth and income. And people die from that. People die from poverty. People die from injustices. And those make up the structural violence. Actually, the direct violence is to some extent the reflection of a structural violence. I would say that the direct violence, wars, genocides, are underpinned by structural violence. They are secondary violence. Structural violence is primary violence, and it kills slowly.
Wow, I think that is pretty deep because the most of us would go after wars. Like there's always discussions about ending wars, but you're looking at kind of the deeper levels that manifest. Like war is almost the manifestation of a lot of suffering that exists in everyday society. So unless you're addressing that level of violence, you're not going to be able to transform the outward manifestation, which is war
Exactly.
and genocide.
And
Wait,
those injustices.
I just wanted to request, can I start the Q&A session while you continue?
Sure.
Yeah. So for our callers, I am now Q&A session. If you have a question, just hit star six, and you will be put in the queue. Sorry, Sri, you can continue.
So go ahead, Bosco, you were saying.
Yeah, so this structural violence is perpetrated by, a handful number of people in the society. Those are people who have the power, political, economic, especially political economic power. And the victims of that structural violence are mostly like the poor. So social justice means you help those poor, those more vulnerable, those marginalized, you help them to, you unlock their potential. You work with them in solidarity with them to regain their power and to change the structures that lead to injustices. And when ordinary people get empowered and understand that the power of people is more than people in power, they can change things and reach a more just and peaceful society.
Well, thank you, Bosco. I can continue, or if there's any questions that we can.
Yes, there's a couple of questions I can. Thank you, Dr. Bosco. This is wonderful. Actually, I can start off with a question. Something you said kind of hit a chord. You said that it's not the suffering that we actually is the difficult part, but making sense of the suffering. And if you understand the meaning of your life, then that suffering becomes more bearable. I was just wondering if you have some story or example or where you noticed that somebody who actually had gone through a lot of suffering was able to understand the meaning of life and that helped them somehow.
So myself, of course, myself, I could transcend my suffering after understand the meaning of my life, the purpose of my life. I had patients who let me share one story with my patient. I had a woman. She's a Rwandan, but she evolved in Tanzania as a refugee, and she was married there. And she was mistreated by her husband. And after genocide, they came back home, but her husband stayed in Tanzania, and they actually divorced. And when she came back home, all the suffering became somatized. You know, she used to come to our clinic like almost every week, complaining of backache, headaches every time, and she was unhappy. And I tried to dig deeper and understand her history. And after understanding her history, I thought that the problem was, you know, psychological, and the problem stemmed from the mistreatment by her husband. I did what we call the freedom of emotional memory, and the suffering actually was alleviated. But I was still seeing her, you know, keeping suffering to some extent. And I would say that I was fortunate to understand holistic medicine. Actually, sometimes you may have a backache because you are poor. You are suffering from the lack of finances. So I learned from her that she had only one child, that she could eat only when the community could contribute some money or food. But she had assets. She had, you know, lands that where she could farm. I only helped her. I say, okay, what do you want to do in your life? How do you want to make sense? What are your plans for tomorrow? In 2 years, 3 years? She said, I want to see myself being productive. I want to have to produce myself. And the treatment he gave, the last treatment, was money. I helped her to, you know, to design a project to exploit her farm, and she did. And 2 months later, after everything was ready, she came very smiling, and she understood. I mean, she was cured. She was healed with a lot of like understanding of her purpose in her life.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, what a lovely conversation to witness between the two doctors. it's really a wish that this conversation, this is the kind of conversation we would like to witness between the doctors and also between the healers and the ones being healed. This is a beautiful gift. Thank you, Sri and Doctor, I also would like to call you Namaste now.
Namaste. Thank you.
My next question is an extension of what playing along what Kanchan was asking. You know, I think many things that you said was like so deeply touching. It's especially this this idea of the holistic view, particularly what you said about it is not the when someone is going through the suffering, it is not just what they looking is not just curing of that disease or the pain, but more deeply finding meaning to their life and a purpose. So my question is sort of two-part. One is, how, in your experience, how do people find meaning? Is suffering part of, you know, that there is this fine line between the breakdown and the breakthrough? Is suffering sort of acts as the underpinning to ignite that in someone? The second part of the question is, how has your own meaning to your life has evolved, seeing others around you find meaning to their life? And now that I have the phone still with me, and I want to add the third one, which is, you see so much of suffering and pain around you, how do you shield yourself from that, not affect you in terms of being your best and not affect you negatively? So those are my three questions. Again, thank you so much for your gift.
Thank you, thank you. So the first question was how the suffering, if I think that the suffering is part of so how do people make meaning, make sense of the suffering, or the suffering itself can be part of that process?
Yes.
So my experience is life is a school. We come here to learn. And the problem with us is whatever circumstances that we do experience, we judge it. We take it as bad or as good. But we don't take it as an opportunity to learn and to discover who we really are. We are peace. We are light. We are love. We are justice. But we cannot know that or discover that until we experience hatred, doubt, violence. Because in the absence of which you are not, what you are is not. Let me say that I cannot say that I'm love until I face a situation of hatred and I show my love.
Oh.
So the suffering for me, it's a trigger. It's an opportunity. It's a provocation to show me, to discover actually, because I cannot show what I'm not aware of. And from my experiences, once you understand that you are love, you are peace, we are who we really are, and then the experience becomes an opportunity to show that. But for those who are not aware of that, it's an opportunity to learn, to discover it. That's one. And once you do integrate the lesson that you have learned, you no longer need to go through that suffering. But again, many people don't know that, and it's our role to help them to understand. second question is,
how is your understanding of the meaning of your life evolved?
It's been a reward. It's been a reward. Like through even the simple story of my patient who said, you know, anytime I come here, I just come to see you because I feel my number of CD4 count increase. So one day I was traveling from, I was flying from Rwanda to Nairobi in Kenya. And this was 6 a.m. A woman called me and she said, "Are you married?" I was a little confused. I didn't respond automatically. And she said, "Oh, doctor, don't be afraid. I just wanted to know if you are married. If yes, I want to pray for you to have a very healthy family. And if not, I want to pray for you to have a very good wife." This was deep. And this was because when she called me, she said, "I had been suffering for a long time. I had never met a doctor who could help me, but I met you, and I'm happy thanks to your guidance, to your help. This is a reward. This is, you know, I'm very happy when I see people, I hear people saying that, when people come to me and say that." The suffering affecting me, you know, I'm emotional, and it's not easy to take distance from the suffering of people. As a doctor, sometimes I cry, and I know ethically, like in our ethics as doctors, we should, you know, avoid too closeness to our patients. But I don't care. So I feel like the suffering of my patients are my suffering. However, I learned something very important. While I feel that compassion, I also let it go. But this has been a long journey to understand that the suffering that someone is going through, it's important for that person. What I need is to help her to learn from it and to transcend, to keep growing. It's an opportunity for her to learn. And my role is to awaken her, to help her just make sense of that and transcend it. It's not easy, but then I say, okay, I have to accept it. I have to let it go. And this helps me to not being affected by the suffering of people who are suffering.
Thank you so much. I can see that you're also using some knowledge from the seminary that you went to in your role. We have Shweta with a question.
Hello, Dr. Bosco.
Hello.
Mambo.
Mambo.
I'm currently calling from Tanzania. So
Bosco,
I'm so excited.
This is my wife. She's in Tanzania right now.
Oh, wow. Nice hearing you. I want to see you sometime.
I'm sure we'll meet soon. I just wanted to say I'm so grateful to have joined this call and also be in the same time zone as you. It's very exciting. Thank you for all the wisdom you have shared. It's been so teaching for me because I'm currently visiting an eye care clinic here in Musoma where they treat people who are visually impaired with cataract surgery and medical treatments. And I have a couple of quick questions for you. Number one is, I know that because you've been U.S. trained, many doctors who have had the opportunity to stay in the United States or work there, do residency there, they take the opportunity. What keeps you in Rwanda and Liberia? And my second question is, how do you begin to speak with others about suffering and healing and compassion and awareness? What is the language that you use for people who don't have any idea of what that means? Thank you again.
Thank you. Thank you so much. The question you asked me about, it's not only doctors or many Africans who go to America, they don't want to come back. The answer is simple for me. I know that you have people who are suffering in the U.S., as we do in Africa, but for me, it makes more sense to start, you know, with my neighbors before I go to other countries or to other continents. I'm a development professional, and my understanding, you know, when I see how Africa has been colonized, I see the most important thing to do for Africa to develop is the decolonization of the mind. People need to come back to themselves to discover who they really are as Africans and as human beings, because it doesn't make sense to say, oh, I'm Rwandan, I'm Africa, I'm American. We need to develop that humanity or global citizenship. But I need to start from my country, from Africa, and, you know, give what I can to help to fuel that movement for social justice. The second question is the language. It depends. I have to learn first how people do understand. I don't have a clear, a precise response, because any patient, any person who is suffering is totally different from another person. What I do, I listen and listen and listen and ask questions. I rarely give instructions, or this is what we call counseling. I ask questions. And once you ask the right questions, people start discover. Say, oh, wow, what? Wow. And then, so this is the method I use. And then when I work with the communities, I do also practice some techniques. I practice Tai Chi. In Liberia, I have not done it because people were not open to it. But in Rwanda, I use it. I use Tai Chi. And Tai Chi, yoga, and other inner practices, like inner martial practices, actually help in the healing process, in transformation. That's it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Shweta, for joining all the way from Tanzania. Shri, did you say you had one more question? Dr. Bosco, before we go ahead, I had a question for you. Would you be able to stay a bit longer? Because we have a couple of questions. Would that? I don't know how your schedule is.
Yeah, no problem.
Oh, thank you. Thank you so much. Shri, do you want to ask a question before?
No, we can have other people ask. You can go ahead. If there's some people in the queue.
Yeah, there's just one more.
Okay.
Good morning, Dr. Bosco. This is Gayatri, and It's been so beautiful listening to your deep and peaceful voice, and praying that Africa shine with peace, prosperity, and happiness. So my question was, I'm currently reading this book. It's The Healing Wisdom of Africa by Melodoma Petris. And in that, you know, he describes about these healing rituals, like the fire rituals, water rituals, earth rituals. And it's so fascinating. I'm like really moved by those. And I was wondering if you also use these kind of healing rituals in your practice, you know, the indigenous way of life in your own holistic medicine. I just wanted to know that.
So,
thank you so much.
Thank you very much. This actually was a discovery very recently.
Okay.
Even if in my psychiatry, my psychiatric courses, I learned that like traditional practices can help people heal.
Mm.
I could not very well understand what it means, because I know in Rwanda we have some traditional practices which the church considers as anti-Christian.
Mm.
However, now I have came to understand that people heal because we heal to some extent because we think, we give that meaning. If someone thinks that water can heal him or her, even if you give any treatment, he will not heal until you give the water. I actually, this is something that I need to integrate in my healing process. And thank you very much for sharing this.
Thank you. Thank you so much. All my very best wishes to you. Thank you.
I just wanted to add one thing, that one New Age spiritualist called Neil Donald Walsh, he's American, he said, "Nothing is real in my world. It's I who make sense of any event."
Wait, say that one more time, Dr. Bosco.
He said that nothing is real in my world. Everything is
illusion.
It's I who give sense. It's I who make sense to whatever happens to me.
Mm.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to kind of, Kunshan's going to close the call, but I just wanted to thank you for your wisdom and the work that you're doing. I think it's been such an inspiration to me and just larger community of service space. And now it's going to be out there on the internet for many people to hear. And I think the one thing that I've noticed kind of doing this work is that we need more African voices, more Rwandan voices that we hear, you know, in the West, telling their own story on their own terms and on your own terms, instead of through our own interpretation. Because as much as I can talk about the work that I'm doing in Liberia and Haiti or anything like that, I think it's much richer and much deeper to hear from people like you that have been born and raised and are part of those communities. And I think getting those voices to the surface much more often is so important. And I think what I respect and appreciate about your own work is that we have a brother Pancho who who always says that the political amongst us need to get a little bit more spiritual, and the spiritual amongst us need to get a little bit more political. And I think you embody that so well in the work. So just thank you in your travels and all your work to making time for this call. And hopefully I will see you in Liberia soon at some point.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's been wonderful. It's been an honor to be in this community. And actually, I can feel that energy. And I'm excited to be part of, you know, this movement, because the world needs us. The world needs to heal and transform.
Definitely. Kanchan, do you want to close? Kanchan, are you there?
Sorry, I was on mute. Hi, yeah. Dr. Bosco, thank you so much for being on the call. And I was wondering what we as a community can do to support your good work.
Oh, many things. You know, now I'm calling from from New York. It's and from the office of a potential supporter for my future project, for the Healing Center project. So one is, you know, even being part of this community helps me as well, because as I share, I also receive the energy from the community. The second thing is to share the work we are doing to other people, so that they can, you know, support in whichever way they are capable to do it, financially, morally, spiritually, whatever they can.
Yeah. And how would GB support? Is there a website, or would we get more information about how to support the project that you're doing?
So the project, I have not decided to to expose it until July next year.
Okay.
Yeah. It's because of the context in Rwanda. So next year, July.
Okay.
Everything will be ready for marketization, but we can share in private.
Okay, great. I'll send you a mail and get some more information from you after the call.
Yeah, and I'll keep the community abreast of the developments of his work in Rwanda.
Okay, thanks, Sri. Thank you, everyone, and. Like we started the call with a minute of silence, we will also end the call with a minute of silence and deep gratitude for the wonderful work that Dr. Bosco, Dr. Sri, and so many others are doing. So just a minute of silence, after which I will unmute everyone. Thank you.